You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
Today, Radiant Creators interviews Kelly Jankowski, author of An Army in Heaven. As a hospice nurse, Kelly has deep experience and perspective with death and dying. Her mission is providing dignified and caring assistance to those transitioning into death. We discuss the contrast between the modern process of birth and death taking place in a hospital versus the home, which was more common in the past. We also speak of the empowering, positive, transformative nature of devoted care for another, and many other topics. How did you get to that moment deciding that your calling was to be a hospice nurse? Because it definitely is.
Well, I had done critical care for so many years that I reached a point in doing that kind of nursing that I just couldn't do it anymore. My favorite patients, I tended to gravitate towards the patients who we weren't going to do all the heroic measures to, because I felt such a connection to them, not only, as a nurse, but you know, as a fellow human being, I could facilitate their comfort without having to worry about what their blood pressure was doing or what, you know, was going on. As long as I could get them comfortable, that was my focus. And it, to me, it was so fulfilling to really be able to make a difference in somebody's life, even if it was just sitting at the bedside and holding their hand, because you're not running around trying to, you know, get drips and monitors and blah, blah, blah. That I felt more and more at ease with those kind of patients than I did with my, my high-tech, really crash-and-burn patients that we used to get. And when we started resuscitating people that were just older and older and older in their 90s, and one lady was 105, I looked at the cardiologist and I said, what are we doing? This just makes no sense to me anymore. I believe that ICU and that kind of nursing is good in certain instances, but there does come a time where it's like enough is enough already. And just because we can doesn't mean we should all the time. So one of my girlfriends at the hospital said, "Have you ever thought about going into hospice?" And I had on and off, but not really. I hadn't really pursued anything. And after that incident that night, I just thought maybe it is something I should look into. So I found an inpatient unit about 25 miles from my home at the time. And so I did both jobs for a while, because, you know, it's one thing to witness death intermittently when you're in an ICU, and to be able to handle that. I didn't know if I was going to be able to handle it on a routine with every patient coming in knowing that they were terminal. I didn't know if I could emotionally handle that, but it didn't take me very long. It didn't take me very long, and I thought, yeah, I'm done with ICU. This is what I want to do full time, and I'm really glad I did, because I've never looked forward to going to a job as much as I have since I've been a hospice nurse. I know people look at that and they think it's kind of morbid, but it's the most fulfilling job I've ever had as a nurse.
Yeah, I like what you mentioned, how just because we can doesn't mean we should. I know I've seen a lot of people who were definitely older in their, you know, 70s, or not that I'm saying 70s is old, it really isn't, but they've been around for a while, and they'll get, like, you know, heart surgery or certain procedures, and if they had done nothing, they probably would have lived, I mean, I know hindsight's 2020, but if they'd done nothing, they probably would have lived more years with a lot more strength and happier. Then,
yeah,
because it seems like some of the procedures wipe a person out.
Oh yeah, they're extremely older. Traumatic. Yeah,
yeah.
Especially when you're going in and you're cracking somebody's chest open and manipulating their insides like that, it is an extremely traumatic type of surgery.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I recently had, gosh, a couple surgeries. I had little stuff, you know. I had to get each kidney zapped. I'm not sure what they call that, but to get rid of a kidney stone.
Oh, the lithotripsy, yeah.
Yeah, and because I moved here to Arizona and just basically didn't drink enough water. Found that staying hydrated was a challenge. I had to take some certain steps to actually stay hydrated enough, you know. So, and that kind of wore me out. They don't do them both at once, but then I also had a surgery. surgery, dual hernias each side, you know, with the robotic surgery. And I thought, you know, they made it out to sound like it was not a big deal, but it hurt like crazy. Oh yeah. My gosh. So I can't imagine what a real operation must be like.
Yeah. It's quite, and I've seen them when I first started in the cardiac ICU down in Houston, Texas. They had us up in the top so you could look down. I can't remember what they used to call it, but when you could look down and watch the actual surgery. And I just couldn't believe it. And this was, you know, how many years ago, when the average length of stay for that kind of surgery is around 2 weeks, 3 weeks sometimes. Now they're in and out in, what, 3 days?
Oh, for actual heart surgery?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they get you up and sitting in the chair by the next day, from what some of my patients have told me who have had it done. And to me, that's just, I mean, compared to what I was doing back in the day and what they're doing now, phenomenal. But still, it's a rough surgery to go through.
Oh, I imagine. Yeah. I mean, now they have hip replacements and knee replacements where the people walk off the operating table. And that still astounds me. I can't imagine something that traumatic being done to the body and you walk to the recovery area. That blows me away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blows me away. Well, I would ask, so you spent plenty of time in hospitals, and I would ask, do you feel that most people in hospitals see life and death, or maybe I would say specifically death, the end, like you do? I mean, because you're around it all the time. I mean, how do people, you're in a hospital and there's birth and there's death happening in the same building. How do people who work in that industry, nurses and doctors, what's it like, you know, when a day in the life is to be around birth and death? Is that an extra challenge in life?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It definitely gives you a different perspective on life. When I first started in nursing, I was absolutely terrified of death. It fascinated me and scared me all at the same time. But the older that I've gotten and the more that I've seen it and the more people that I've encountered going through this process, it puts things into perspective that it couldn't otherwise if you weren't involved in this kind of career. I tend to think about God a lot more than I did when I was young. And when I see my patients in the bed, it really hits home that we're all going to be there someday. And I often, you know, kind of try to put my foot in the shoe of the woman sitting next to her husband, because how would I feel if my husband was lying in the bed? And that perspective, I think, when you keep that in the forefront of your brain, will make you a better nurse. So it'll make you more compassionate, because these are not numbers. They're not disease processes. They're human beings who have a history and a life and loved ones who, at the time that I meet them, are devastated. And it really does tend to put your entire life into you prioritize things differently. You don't sweat the small stuff anymore. And you realize after listening to people with the regrets that they're facing as they reach the end of their life, the regrets of, I wish I should have spent more time with my family. I wish I didn't have to work so much. I wish I didn't do this and didn't do that. I wish I did this. And, you know, you hear that over and over and over again. And it really makes you realize that, you know, life is very, very short and I should not worry about this, that, and the other. I should focus on my family and, you know, and more on God. Truly, that's what it has done for me.
Yeah. Do you find that having a spiritual life, helps in working in the environment that you do? To me, it seems like it'd be much easier for a person who had a spiritual life and a spiritual faith, be much easier than an individual who was an atheist.
Well, you know, wasn't there an old saying that there's no atheists in foxholes? I think that when people reach the end, even those that have not practiced any sort of religion or have not had any sort of real relationship with God, they either continue in that path where they don't want a relationship with Him up until the end, or they second guess the way they lived their life, and then they reach out for Him and they grasp on to whatever you can give them to bring them comfort. I see that more than I see people not wanting anything to do with God. Although there are plenty of people who will show up in our unit that say, "Don't you talk to me about God? Don't you talk to me about an afterlife? I don't believe in any of it." And so, you know, we as human, we as nurses have to honor their wishes. Me personally, it doesn't stop me from praying for them because, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic, and I just believe. I don't push my beliefs on other people, but that I still pray for people. But there are plenty of people who go through this and they struggle with their faith. And I've seen people too that have an incredible faith who even struggle and have doubts and fears towards the end. I think it's kind of in human nature to have a fear of the unknown and what's coming next and did I do everything right? And you know, all your doubts and fears come bubble up towards the surface towards the end.
Oh, for sure. Well, I mean, everybody has faith, just kind of like everybody's very heroic. When it's easy, it's when you're tested. That's when you truly find out what you've got.
I mean, yeah. Well, they say that the living are very brave. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Because I often think, how am I going to react when I'm faced with a terminal illness or whatever? You never know. You never know until you're put in that situation. I hope and pray that the faith that I've practiced my entire life, I will cling to as I do every day, even towards the end. But I see a lot of people that their doubts and fears bubble up. And, you know, you just hope and pray that you can persevere till the end.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there is those famous Five Regrets of the Dying, I think by Bonnie Ward. She wrote Top Five Regrets of the Dying. That, mm-hmm. And if one has been close to death, they definitely take that to heart. I know that I was in the military when I was younger and was, close to dying a time or two, and I didn't, obviously. But what always stuck with me, I think, of course, the Five Regrets of the Dying, most people know those, but one that caught me was disappointment. And, you know, we want to live, we want to be alive. If nothing else, is a, you know, biological imperative to be alive as a, you know, a human. But that was very life-changing for me because I just felt a serene, it wasn't really negative, but just a certain disappointment in that I wasn't going to get to keep living. And there was things that I still wanted to do. And it really, I think it helped me cultivate the sweetness of every day, like just the sweetness of life. Mm-hmm. And that's what being close to death offered me. You know, now when that time comes, I can't imagine it not being challenging because it's yeah. just it's overwhelming. I mean, it's really happening to you, and now you know. Well, there's a guy, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, and he's the author of a famous book called On Killing. And he really studied kind of death in combat for endless years. And it's a very interesting book, a couple books he wrote, and they're very good for people who are recovering from the military, PTSD and such. But something he said about death and why we have a hard time with it in our society is that birth is hidden from us in a hospital. We don't see it. And then death is hidden from us in a hospital. But in our older cultures, you know, back in the day, that time in the past, you would, you know, especially like in a tribal community, there'd be copulation happening, there'd be birth happening, there'd be happiness, there'd be sickness, and there'd be death. And do you feel that death is hidden from people, kind of like life and birth is hidden from people? It, like most people in their whole lives, unless they're a mother and they give birth, they'll probably never see a baby being born. And then most people, the only death they ever see is their own and maybe a loved one or two. But both birth and death seem really removed in our society.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even in the Victorian era, they used to have the wakes right in their home. People would die at home and they'd be laid out in their home and then they'd go to the gravesite. Today it is almost saccharinized. It's like sugar sweet and don't think about it and don't talk about it. And even when I worked in the hospital, if a patient would die and we would have to transport them down to the morgue, they used to have this contraption that would fit over the gurney. You'd put the body in a zip up, you know, kind of case, and you'd place them on the gurney, and then you'd put this form over it that looks like a big square, so you couldn't see an outline of a body. It's like nobody was allowed to die, and if you had died in a hospital, then, you know, you sure couldn't let anybody know because they camouflaged it going down the hallway that, you know. I think there's an inordinate fear about death in this society, but it's going to happen to every single one of us. And to be afraid of it and to mask over it and you know, hang some tinsel on it or whatever is not doing anybody any good. Because then when they have a loved one that ends up in a situation where death is approaching, they freak out. I've had family members become completely hysterical when their grandmother's dying, who's 97, 98 years old. But this is part of life, and it's almost like we're not even teaching it anymore. And it's a sad state of affairs because, like I said, it's going to happen to every single one of us. And it's the one thing in life that is guaranteed. You're going to be born and you're going to die. Everything else in the middle is different for everybody, but everybody's going to die. And I just think that it needs to be more directly encountered. It needs to be talked about. I mean, we have patients all the time who come in who have been married 50, 60 years, never once talked about what they wanted, what their choices were if this and that happens. You know, like advanced directives or even a funeral, or how do I pay bills? Because you're leaving and you always paid the bills. And it's not even discussed. So when people are met with this and they lose a spouse, they have no idea what to do. They don't know how to pay. They haven't paid a bill their entire marriage. They don't know how to fill up a car with gas. They don't know. Do you know what I mean? These things should be talked about from the time we're born until the time we die, because it's going to happen to us all. So we need to be prepared. I don't think you can be prepared enough.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely.
Did I answer your question? I sometimes get off on a tangent.
No, completely. I would say that, yeah, I mean, can we ever be, you know, prepared enough emotionally? Well, that, you know, probably not. But I can definitely say that if you're prepared paperwork-wise and financially, that it's going to make it easier emotionally.
So, well, and it's a way to kind of open up the door for conversation, to, you know, to talk about it. But I've taken care of plenty of couples who come in and they're like, nope, we don't want to talk about that. Nope, I'm just going to put that. It's almost like if I put it on the back burner and I ignore it, it'll go away. But it's not going to go away. So it's, you know.
Yeah, that's got to be a difficult situation because, I've often thought that I've mentioned to people, if you love your family, then write a very, very explicit, to the point, detailed will and have everything worked out. Because, yeah, you know, if it's all written and there's no debate and you have an executor, you know, from outside the family handle it, then everybody will love each other still after you pass. But if you don't, well, that's where a lot of families all part ways, you know.
Well, and when you put a family that has any sort of dysfunction, and you know, none of us are exempt from that. I mean, there's dysfunction in almost every family. It bubbles to the surface under terrible stress and tension. And part of our job as in hospice is to help these families through this. I mean, you're not going to fix their family issues, but you have to help people through this because it's completely stressful. I mean, I've had plenty of people say, I didn't hear a thing the doctor said when he told me. Once I heard cancer, I haven't heard anything after that, because their brains just, you know, they get overwhelmed. And that happens too with family members too. I mean, in any little issues that they had growing up or whatever, it all just comes to a head during these times. And yeah.
Oh, definitely, because now you've got the possibility of loss of a loved one, and you also have, you know, everyone fears sickness, and then, of course, you know, change in the family structure, and it's almost like with one event, you know, somebody dying, you've actually triggered everybody's dysfunction. you've got it all somewhere in there. You've hit it, and now you have all. Yep. And so every dysfunction that a family has is now present. That's, and yeah. I would say A question I would ask is, have you had anybody come in to hospice who, of course, I'll use the word transitioned, you know, came in alive, left, not alive, that came in an atheist, or just let's say somebody who didn't have a spiritual life whatsoever. I'm not, you know, looking at any specific type of spiritual life, but just didn't have a spiritual life, kind of believed in nothing. They thought, well, you know, we're an animal here by chance, we're born, we die, that's it, lights on, lights off. Mm-hmm. Did anyone ever, you know, come in an atheist and then leave an atheist, you know, come in an atheist and then transition an atheist? Or, and if they did, were they comfortable with it? Was anyone ever just, I don't believe in anything, I have no spirituality, the lights are going to go off, and I don't care because I won't know?
Yeah, we do. I took care of a lady many years ago who, one of her, she was very, verbal about her atheism beliefs. But towards the end, when she was, going through the dying process, she was seeing different things. And, she said, well, I know who that is. I think that's who they call Jesus, but I don't know who this is over here. And then shortly after that became extremely agitated. Couldn't really tell us what was going on. But she was seeing something. But as the hours progressed, she just became more and more lethargic and ended up, becoming unresponsive, and 2 days later died. I don't know if she came to terms with what she was seeing, or if she accepted what she was seeing, or if she continued in her denial. It's very difficult to say. And then you'll have patients who come in who say, I don't believe, and then we'll start seeing things and go, you know, they'll just repeat over and over and over again. I can't believe I was so wrong. I can't believe I was so wrong. And then you'll get other people come in that are atheists who are atheists to the very end. It is such a wide array of people that we encounter with all sorts of spiritual beliefs and or non-beliefs. And we're taught as nurses and as hospice nurses, we're not here to judge people. We're here to care for you. And so you have to meet people where they are, you know, and help them through it as best you can. I mean, that's my job. My job is not to convert people from their atheism into Christianity or Judaism or whatever. My job is to care for them and do the best job that I can. But it's difficult to watch because some people get very, very agitated. Some people tell me what they see and it's not good. It's outlined in, there's a couple chapters outlined in my book where I've seen people that have really had some spiritual battles going on. And sometimes I've seen beautiful deaths on the other hand too. So it's just a wide array of people.
Yeah. I've heard from some people I know recently who've had loved ones die that the individual who was getting ready to go, and this would be, you know, an older person who was, you know, had been going out for a little while, and now they were getting, you know, close, so they went to hospice. Mm-hmm. That within like a week or so of them dying, approximately, a loved one would appear to that person. Is that something that you've noticed at all? That in that week or so, or sometime soon before an individual dies, that someone from their past, a loved one, someone maybe that would be a guide for them, they see them in a vision, they arrive and talk to them.
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. It happens so often that you just can't not believe it, because they will have full-on conversations with them. And you'll hear, I'll sometimes stand outside the room when I hear somebody talk, and I know there's no visitors in the room. When I hear somebody talking in the room, I'll stand outside the door because I want to hear what they say too. And I want to judge kind of where they are in their journey, because it's more often than not that people show up on patients' deathbeds. But they'll have give and take conversations, and you'll hear the patient talk for a while, and then he'll pause. Well, yeah, that's what I thought he'll say. And then, but the other day when I was talking to blah, 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 you know, and it's just a conversation that you would be listening to, even though you can't hear the other side. You hear the responses and the questions and the answers and stuff going back and forth. It's really quite fascinating. And the thing that I think is the most intriguing about that phenomena that happens is that my mom, we buried my mom a week ago, well, last Saturday, and my dad died 6 years ago. If I was laying in a hospital bed and my dad walked in or my mom walked in, because they are full blown apparitions, there is a solid to these people looking as you and me. If they walked into my, I'd freak the heck out. Yeah. I mean, I would be totally like, what are you doing here? You're dead. But these patients, on the other hand, they view this as no big deal. They don't become alarmed at it. They don't become frightened of it. If anything, they obtain a sense of peace. It's really, really fascinating to witness.
That is amazing. And along with that, I guess the next, you know, question I would think of is after someone passes, have you seen any, is it common that that person visits their loved ones to let them know that they're okay?
And I don't do a lot of work with bereavement, but yeah. A couple of nurses that I know that have done that sort of work, they will have different things happen to them. One of our patient's spouses was sitting at her desk and kind of coming unglued. She was at home, kind of coming unglued, going through, you know, because grief comes in waves. You know, you're fine 1 minute, and then out of the blue, sometimes you just grief will overwhelm you. She was sitting at her desk, trying to write thank you notes. And she became overwhelmed with grief and she started sobbing and stuff, and then immediately smelled her husband's aftershave. And there's just, you know, his aftershave was upstairs in the bedroom. And it stayed there for a few minutes and then it dissipated. And she said that she knew that she felt that he was there and that he was there to comfort her, and then she felt better. And so she would talk about it during, you know, her bereavement. What do you call it? When she'd get together with one of our bereavement counselors for help during this time. And
counseling or?
Bereavement is offered to every family member who experiences a loss up to, I think, 13 months after the death, where you can come in anytime and talk to somebody. And they have groups, they have bereavement groups that meet like once a week or however often you need them to meet, and they help you through it. And a lot of the times it's just getting people to verbalize that helps them work through it. Hospice is a good program. It truly is. We have a lot to offer our families and our patients. So, but I'm a little bit, you know, biased. So.
Oh, that's fine to be biased. It's good. Because when I looking at your book on Amazon, which I did read the whole book, but when I was looking at the reviews on Amazon, I was amazed how I rarely see people's books that have such a preponderance of positive reviews, of 5-star reviews. You know, most are kind of mixed, but yours is outstandingly positive. And looking at some of the comments people left, some of the comments were people, a good deal of them were people that you'd worked with, their families. And one great comment was, Kelly and the rest of the staff made her, she was speaking of her mother, Kelly and the rest of the staff made her the queen she was for a week.
Oh, I remember that woman.
Yeah, and that's wonderful. And it really seems like, looking at those comments, that you really are working to enable a patient's dignity that maybe they'd been lacking to some extent leading up to their death. And so making them queen or king for a week or a day, and, you know, helping them find that dignity. I can imagine that some people who've been sick and not doing well, I've often seen where, you mentioned it in the book, but also I saw it in the comments, where it was the first bath and shave they'd gotten in a while, and they looked better than they had in some time. So can you speak to that? That feels like, to me, you know, quite part of your mission there is to make the dying person king or queen for a week, really help them really get their dignity right up front and feel good as they're making that transition, and you really are helping the passing individual and the family. It seems like you're really elevating the whole situation.
Well, I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital before.
Yes.
I was in the hospital one time, and they were understaffed. I had some surgery done, and it had been like almost 3 days since they came in and helped me with a bath, but I couldn't walk to the bathroom. You know, I needed assistance at the time. And one little nursing assistant came in, she set me up with warm water, and she helped me get bathed and stuff. And I remember that feeling that, oh my gosh, you know, it's been 3 days. I hugged her because I'm like, you're the first person that offered me a toothbrush, you know. And my husband wasn't around at the time. He was deployed. But I remember that feeling. And then when I started into hospice, and I always did this in critical care too, I always tried my best to keep my patients very clean. But when we get patients into our unit, a lot of the times they're in a pain crisis. They've been in pain for so long. And I don't know if you've ever had pain for a really long time, but if you've had kidney stones, you probably have. That is very, you can't sleep, you can't rest. It makes you tense. It will grate on your mind after a while. But once we get patients' pain under control, we give them a complete bed bath. We'll shampoo their hair even while they're lying in the bed. You know, it gets a little wet, but you know, they get them good and clean. And I'll never forget the man that we had gotten into our unit from one of the big hospitals in my area. And he had probably an inch and a half beard. When I was talking to the family, and I was getting their history and kind of, you know, about him while the nursing assistant started to set him up for a bath, I asked his wife, I said, does your husband normally wear a beard? And she slammed her fist down on the table and she goes, 5 weeks. 5 weeks that man was in the hospital. I think he got bathed twice. And I said, okay, honey, don't worry. We'll take care of that. So I left him in there. I got him some coffee. I said, give us some time. I went in there and we gave him an insane bath. I mean, we just scrubbed him from head to foot. I don't know how many buckets of water we went through because he was quite dirty. And I shaved him. We shampooed his hair. We had him cleaned out his mouth, did all of that. And then I went to the dining room and I got her. And when I brought her back in, she leaned over the bed and she gave him a kiss and she started to cry. And she said, I just can't believe how good he looks. And thank you so much because this looks like my husband now. He doesn't look like a homeless man. And that had such an impression on me, just that little thing of bathing somebody and getting them clean and cleaning out their mouth and giving them a shave had such an impression. And I thought, yeah, this is why we do what we do, because to return somebody back to the way that they should be kept and clean. And, you know, that's part of human dignity is to be clean. I mean, I couldn't go 5 weeks with only two showers, you know? So it made such an impression on me that I always try and do that, to the nth degree for my patients, because I know personally how well how good you feel when you're clean. And I remember what an impression that had on this little guy's wife. So,
oh, I can imagine. Yeah, I've had some pain. It didn't last that long, but, you know, a week or so. And it was intense from, you know, injuries, et cetera, in the past. And yeah, it starts to, it affects the mind. It will definitely affect your state of mind. You're eventually not yourself. You're just,
right.
You're at least very down about life, if nothing else, you know. Well, I can definitely say, like, with shaving, that one speaks to me because well, I was in the military when I was young, and one thing that never really wore off was being clean shaven. I, you know, like the day does not start until I shave. It's pretty much,
yeah.
I can only imagine some guy who didn't like having a beard. Men either like a beard or they don't know how anybody could have that stuff on their face, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that'd be the best part of my experience. If I couldn't shave and then somebody shaved me, I'd be like, oh, I'm alive again. Thank heavens. Oh, well. Along with that, you know, I know a lot of people ponder, and I'll ask you, since I think you'd have a good insight onto this, I'd imagine, is being a nurse. I know there's many different types of nurses, and there's a lot of different, you know, roles in the hospital or medical industry. I mean, from being a nurse to an anesthesiologist, there's all kinds of people who are working there, and maybe I guess they're not all nurses, but I'm going to say just for the sake of simplicity, nurses and people who work there. Is it a job or a passion for most? Because I know that many of us wonder, because like I got an operation recently with my hernia, and I went to Honor Health here in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'd never been to like a big place like that. And I walked in and I was like, oh my gosh, there must have been 100 other people getting ready for surgery. And here I am in this assembly line, and it's kind of scary. But by the time I got laid down and was surrounded by all these kind and loving people taking care of me, I thought I was in a cozy little hospital room. I didn't even realize that I was in an assembly line.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah. For a lot of nurses, it's a calling. I've met nurses who should not be nurses. I've told people that were interested in nursing, I said, unless you love people, unless you truly care about people, you're not going to be worth a crap as a nurse. Excuse my French. Because if you're in it for the money or for the, you know, work 3-12 hours a week, that's the wrong reason to go into it. And you won't be effective as it. If anything, you'll just tick a lot of people off because your attitude will reflect it. It's impossible for your attitude not to reflect it. Because if you look at this sort of vocation as a job, just a 12 hour shift, 3 days a week, you're going to burn out really, really quickly, really quickly. And I've seen my share of nurses who I've not recommended to like enter our unit as a staff member or come into our hospice because their hearts aren't in it. And you can't take people who, like, just for example, like a World War II vet or a Korean War vet or a Vietnam vet. These people have been through hell and back, and they deserve every ounce of TLC you can give them. That's my viewpoint on it. Just those patients in particular. I mean, I try and treat all my patients as though they were king and queens, but when you get your vets in there, and because my husband is a vet himself, these people deserve to have all that TLC at the end. And if your heart isn't in it, you can't do it. You just can't do it and do it effectively and do it to the level that these patients deserve, in my opinion. So, and I've seen nurses whose hearts aren't in it and they're short tempered and they could give a hoot less if you've been sitting on a bedpan for 10 minutes. Or if you've had the call light going for 20 minutes and nobody's come in your room, those are the kind of nurses that should not be in nursing. Unfortunately, they're out there. But if I could go into teaching, I would sit every single one of my students down in a classroom and say, if this is why you want to be a nurse, don't go into it. You know?
Oh yeah. If it's about benefit packages and retirement, right, that's probably not a good reason to be a nurse. Maybe go into like IT or something if that's where, because
right,
then you don't need passion.
Right. I mean, there you do go. Something that isn't customer service related.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, really, be a plumber or something like that. But even then, you have to kind of care about what you do and the people that you're doing it for. It seems like not much in life really works if we don't have a passion for it.
Yeah.
If it's not our calling.
Yeah.
Here's one. Do you think that people, especially children, would benefit from helping with hospice care? As children it was common and throughout, growing up, that people just kind of did a bit of volunteer work if they were willing in hospice just to sit with people. Do you think that would help our society have a better relationship to death?
I think children view death much better than what people give them credit for. As a matter of fact, my granddaughter just lost her great grandmother not long ago. And my daughter took her over to her home. She was in hospice care and took her over to her home, and she'd crawl up in bed with her and she'd snuggle up to her. And at this point, the little lady's she's unconscious. But my granddaughter had a viewpoint of, you're going home soon to God, and I'm going to be here when you go. Nobody prompted her to say anything like that, but she had such a viewpoint on it that this is part, I mean, automatically, this is part of life and everybody's going to die and it's your time now, blah, blah. She's very matter of fact about it. I think when we shelter our children from these things that we do them a disservice because then the fear comes up and there's a lot of misconceptions and that get ingrained in people. I just think that this society, we really seriously have to reevaluate our outlook on death and dying.
I like how you mentioned how children seem to just be naturally okay with it. It reminds me of how on a plane, if you're flying and the plane encounters turbulence, you know, which just always makes me very happy and relaxed, you know, it really does. Everybody's kind of nervous, especially if the turbulence is a little bit intense. Everybody's, oh my gosh, you know, unhappy, ordering more drinks. And the kids, what are they doing? They're jumping up and down their seats. They think it's so amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, their perception is different. So I'd love to see that too, if that relationship to death was cultivated like that as they were when children are children.
It's funny that you should mention that because back in 2001, we went to a family reunion in Nebraska, and we were sitting in the very back of this plane with you know, five of the six kids. And we encountered turbulence, and my kids had never been on a plane before, and I'm sitting in the very back seat, and they're all in front of me. And then next thing you know, they got their hands up the air going, put your hands up, like they're on a roller coaster. And I'm white-knuckling the handrails, and they're just having a ball.
I know, it's amazing. Yeah, and I it's always a profound moment when I see that when I'm on a plane. I go, you know, I know I'm not in danger. Planes could care less if there's turbulence, and I think, you know, why am I not in my natural state? My natural state is I should be playing too, because it is just fun. What am I worried about? So it shows, to cultivate that. I think of a cousin that I had. I'm not sure if he's still alive. I haven't seen him in a good number of years, but he was just kind of born troubled, you know, in and out of jail. His whole life was a real mess. And I think the only humanity this guy had was that his grandmother was lived with his family, and when the grandmother was dying, like her last weeks in bed, he ended up just sitting with her. He ended up just sleeping on a futon on the floor next to her, and he really became completely a part of her experience dying. And I remember when she died, he was just devastated and crying and had. And it was something, it's this rather hardened criminal was just destroyed by this. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say that it's quite a statement, but I think the only humanity that he had, the only connection to life or others that he ever had was that couple weeks of her dying and being with her. Yeah.
It's really, like I said, it really will put a different perspective on it. But I think when you have people like that are, you know, into that kind of lifestyle, if you put them in a situation where they have to serve another human being, where they have to do something good for somebody else, and just the fact that he put a bed right next to hers and stayed there with them, with her when she was dying, I mean, that speaks volumes. And I think if you put somebody in a situation where they have to come out of themselves and give to another human being, it really has a way of reorienting them, even if it's only for the moment or the span of time that they have doing that. It really tends to reorient their whole focus away from themselves and onto somebody else and do some good. It's just a personal opinion, though.
I think it's totally valid to me because I saw that I think it makes sense, of course, but also having seen that where somebody I knew who was just, I don't know, didn't do too many good things in his life, seemed determined to, you know, be a pain in society's butt. But that one experience, he was as emotionally honest and as good as one of those little kids on the airplane dancing in the turbulence for that. Mm-hmm. That was kind of his one, I guess you could say, experience, a shot at redemption in life. was that. And he, at least in that moment, he passed the test.
You know? Yeah.
I would say that
there's hope for him yet then.
Oh no, there's still, yeah. And I'm not sure if he's gotten there yet or not. I don't know. Haven't seen him, but, you know, at least he, did one good deed, and maybe he's still alive. I'm not sure, but I would say, so many of us, like one thing that's definitely prompted interviewing you is, like I mentioned, just, it seems like in my circle of people that I know, we've all, encountered, you know, death recently, and the one individual will pass, transition, die, and then of course the family is left behind, and it seems like the grieving can take sometimes, well, hours for some people. Some people don't care. Some people it's a month. Some people it's a year. Do you find that people give themselves permission to grieve? I mean, after someone dies, I would ask, you know, what should a person do? I know it's not exactly your line of work, but how can a person deal with that sudden, just overwhelming grief and those just waves of grief that come to them? Do you have any advice for people along those lines, or what have you seen that seemed to work?
Well, grief is very much an individualized thing, and there's really no right or wrong to it. Because everybody will grieve differently. Some people, like you say, it comes and it lasts for a short amount of time. Some people like compartmentalize it. And so they'll put it in a little box over here and they'll look at it every once in a while. But for the most part, they put it aside. And then you have other people that are inside the box grieving the whole time. It's very much an individualized kind of process. And the process starts from diagnosis, when they hear their loved one or the patient is diagnosed with it. That grieving period starts from there and then basically consummates at the actual death and then continues on for that as they try to deal with it. I find that if people are, if it is taking months and months and they're not really wanting to get out of bed and they're not wanting to go to work and they're letting stuff go and stuff like that, that you might need a little help to kind of just working through it. You know, because if it's been 6 months and you're still, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're still in your bathroom, there might be an issue. There might be an issue. It might be a little more of a complicated grief than, you know, what a normal situation would entail. But, you know, there's grief counselors and through the bereavement centers and the hospices that are trained to deal with this and help people through it. As hospice staff, we're trained to deal with it in a different way because we've got the patients and the families right there in the moment. We really don't see them when the patient dies and they've left the unit. Some of them will come back and say hello and blah blah blah, but we don't see them in a continuing on after that. So it's always a good idea if you're feeling like, you know, life has lost its meaning and it's been 6 months and 8 months and 10 months, that it might be a good idea to really get some help through that.
Definitely. I would say so. And it seems to me helpful. Something I've noticed is people need to give themselves, well, permission to grieve and then also to figure out their own plan, their own method on working through it. Because like you mentioned, it is individual.
Right. And so what would be good for you or what feels right for you in your grieving process, you can't dictate to somebody else. Well, why are you feeling like that? It's been, you know, so many months. You can't do that to a person because it doesn't work. It doesn't open any sort of channel of, you know, communication and conversation. It kind of slams the door shut. So people need to be patient with themselves and realize that, you know, this is a process and I'm going to get through this. And, you know, and if they can't, then there's plenty of places out there where they can get help. And through hospice, it's free of charge, like I said, up to 13 months afterwards. So,
that's really amazing. Yeah. I worked with a grief counselor only for an hour after someone close to me died. And that was, it just happened to be that they were a family friend and they just called to see how I was doing, but they were a grief counselor. So they threw a little grief counseling on me and I was, I was amazed. I honestly cannot even describe the experience, but I'd only would recommend to people, no matter what they may think that that person can't help or it's silly. It was absolutely profound experience. They're good. They're really,
yes,
really good.
They're very good. They're really, yes, good.
Better than a person thinks who hasn't worked with one.
They also have them for children too. And one of the hospices I worked with, they had a child life specialist who was phenomenal with children. You talk about a woman that had a knack for what she did. But she could take a child who was like, had his arms folded and not wanting to talk to anybody with a scowl on his face. And within 10 minutes, they're talking and putting a puzzle together and he's opening up about his grandma or his grandpa or his dad or whatever. Yeah. It really, really does help. And they're very specifically trained for this. And they can do wonders with somebody who's struggling.
Yeah. I also noticed in being around people who are, you know, really deeply grieving a death that was, you know, close to them, was just being present for that person and letting them know that, you know, whatever you might need, whatever might move you to help you through this, just let me know if you want company. And if you really provide that to somebody, if you, you know, truly are sincere, it seems like you might get this request, you know, they'll call you and they'll say, you know, I'd really like to just go rent mopeds and ride around aimlessly all day and
right.
Go do it. I mean, because that might be that day might be what they need to really start living again and just be available to whatever their whim is.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's very important to be a good friend if you've got a friend going through this, because we're all going to be there and we're all going to need somebody to lean on every once in a while. And, you know, it's a treasure to have a good friend who can do those things.
Oh, definitely. And I think also in these times when, you know, someone does die close to us, we oftentimes find out who our friends are. And usually it's a good thing, but I find that you find that you, you know, had friends and you find that you knew people that had a greater quality than you were even aware of. And it's amazing that people come out of the woodwork and are just suddenly completely there for you. So much more than they had to be. They didn't have to, but they were. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we all know the five regrets of the dying, that those famous five, the I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, and I wish I hadn't worked so hard, and I wish I had the courage to express my feelings, I wish I had stayed in touch, and I wish I had let myself be happier. We know those. Is there anyone, do you think, that is missing there, any regret of the dying that you've noticed that's not one of those common five?
They're all kind of, you know, you can bundle them up under under those five different categories. What I have seen though, first of all, what I've noticed in my hospice patients is that they tend to be very open. People that wouldn't open up about themselves or whatever, you get very talkative. And I'll sit down and chit chat with them. And within a matter of, you know, half an hour, I know their entire life history. So they tend to, it's almost like they're like, purging themselves of, you know, different things. But what I've noticed a lot is, I've had patients tell me when they start seeing things, they'll say stuff like, had I known what was really on the other side, I would have done this, that, and this, that, and this, that. Or I would have been a better man, or I would have paid more attention to God because he loves me so much. I see that. And I hear that a lot. So I think the relationship, that we have with the one who created us, would have been better taken care of and better and more readily pursued. Because I see a lot of regret in people and you'll get people. I had a guy, he's in my book, who said, but what if I'm not good enough? What if I didn't make the cut? What if God isn't really gonna, you know, so all those doubts come in, and then he saw what was waiting for him on the other side. And that's when he grabbed my arms and he said, Kelly, tell all your patients there's nothing to be afraid of because God loves you more than, you know, words can say. I see that a lot.
And to cultivate that and know that throughout one's life probably is maybe the most effective way to get ready for death. Mm-hmm. You know, I think so. That might be the best. That's awesome. Well, I know it's getting near an hour here, so definitely want to wrap it up. But I wanted to ask, probably everybody asks about this guy. I have maybe a specific question. In the book, there's an amazing chapter. I think it's the last one, Douglas, A Demon Within. you know, and how your nurse's assistant actually mentioned there's something evil in that room and she didn't want to go back in. So we'll let people read the book to find out the details on Douglas, but definitely this man seemed kind of possessed. And I wonder, in the book you mentioned, you document very well, that he knew things about you and others in the hospital that no one else could have known.
No.
And I just wonder, where do you think that intelligence comes from? I mean, where did he get that info? Is it that he truly was possessed and that just gives him certain knowledge that a person would not? I just wonder, what do you think was going on with that guy? What do you think happened?
The fact that he knew things about both of us that there is absolutely no way. There is absolutely no way he could have known speaks volumes. Because knowledge of the hidden and knowledge of the, you know, what people, the unknown that we don't know is given to the angels. And if devils are fallen angels, they retain their intelligence. So it was probably the worst. Oh, no, I should say probably it was the worst experience I've ever had as a nurse on a spiritual level. It took everything I had to go into that room. Because the whole atmosphere in the room was thick and oppressive and mean, and it just the way he would look at you, you can't put it into words very well. I had my thesaurus out when I was writing that chapter because it was creepy without a doubt, and the different things that he would do and say and It was, to me, there was no doubt the man was possessed. There's just no doubt.
Did you feel like after that experience of being around somebody who was possessed, did it give you more of an eye to see it? Like since then, have you noticed, like, out in the public, like seeing a person that looks possessed? did it give you a more keen eye for it?
I never really looked at people like that. But I mean, I've taken care of patients who I thought were a little bit delving into the wrong things. Cause there's a look that they give you that it's a ice cold, dead kind of stare. And they don't really stare at you. They like stare through you kind of look. It's hard to describe, but once you've seen it, you'll know it. And I've had patients that have looked at me at different ways, or they act different ways, but nobody like Douglas. Douglas was by far the worst. But I mean, you talk to any hospice nurse. I've talked to a few hospice friends of mine who have had experiences, I mean, terrifying experiences like that, where the intercom goes on and a voice will come through. One of my girlfriends, she had a patient die and they had called in a priest because he apparently was wanting sacraments or last sacraments. And so they called in a priest. And when the priest came out of the room, his crucifix had bent to the side. And I mean, the priest was shook up. I wasn't there for this, but she told me that they were getting ready to call the funeral home. And when she picked up the phone to dial the funeral home, a voice came from the intercom from room 12 that's saying, "Don't you dare, I'm not done with her yet." And I'm like, oh yeah, I probably would have left. Yeah, it freaked everybody out. And a day shift nurse left that day and never came back. So...
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, those experiences. Yeah. Wow. Well, that could definitely be a chapter in a future book, that look that they give you. That look that they give you. Oh my gosh, you know. Oh, well, I guess you definitely have touched a lot of people over here that we've all been looking at your book, and I definitely want you to, we all want you to keep writing. It's great work. And I would ask, what are you working on now? Is there going to be a future book? What's going on? And how can people follow you and get a hold of you and get your book, et cetera?
Well, I am working on another book. It's probably not going to be out for a while. I've just kind of been thinking about it. but I've been asked that a lot. I've been asked it so much that I thought, well, maybe I should. So I've you know, I'm updating my journals and I'm continuing to write in my journals about my different patients. But my book's available on Amazon. It's also on spiritdaily.com. He keeps it in his bookstore. I think if you just go into Google and you put in an army in heaven, all these avenues will open up where you can buy it. I don't have a lot. I'm computer illiterate, truly. So as far as like social media, I'm a little inept at it. But an army in heaven is. I've got a Facebook page for Army in Heaven, and if you go to the Amazon author page down there, you'll find on the left, you'll find my email address for the book, and people can contact me through there.
Yeah, I noticed that. You put your email address there in your bio on Amazon, which I think is pretty amazing because people really they really can get a hold of you. Most authors don't do that. And well, I'll tell you what, if you're not, as you put it, computer illiterate, I don't think you're computer illiterate. I would just say maybe you're a little bit too smart for it, because I would say that the social media world right now is no place for a kind person anyway. So, I think that you're doing your work, you know, you're really experiencing life, you're doing your work, you're helping people, and you wrote your book and you put that out there and you're talking to people in interviews. And I would say that is far more than social media can offer anyway. So just keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, will do.
All right. Well, you take care. And it was so great talking to you.
Oh, you too. I can't believe an hour's up already.
I know. I know. I had a feeling the interview would just, I didn't have a whole lot of notes for it. I had a feeling that it would just flow. I had this feeling that I should talk to you and that what was needed was going to come out, and we'll get this out in the next day or so.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'll send you a link.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, bye-bye. Bye.